Hi, everybody, and welcome to the live fundraising success webinar, Donor Loyalty, Doing What It Takes to Keep Supporters Involved, sponsored by Serenic Software. I'm Margaret Battistelli-Gardner, Editor-in-Chief of Fundraising Success, and your host for today. There's no doubt that donor attrition strikes a devastating blow to a nonprofit's donor files and also negatively affects donations. And everyone knows it costs a lot more to get a new donor than it does to retain current ones. So if your organization's retention efforts aren't fine-tuned just yet, this is the perfect time to focus on them, and you've come to the right place. But before we get started, let me point out a few quick tips on how to make the most of today's live webinar. First, if you have any technical difficulties, troubleshoot by clicking on the Help widget at the bottom of the console, marked with a question mark, or let us know via the Q&A box. And I have to warn you, I tend to giggle every time I say widget, so and I'm going to say widget a lot in the next few seconds. But anyway, you can also use the Q&A box to submit your questions to today's panelists. We'll be addressing select questions at the end of the hour, but you can send them in at any time. Please make sure you turn off any pop-up blockers on your computer so that you can utilize all of the widgets and the bells and the whistles on the console. And speaking of bells and whistles, please click on the Tips for Attendees widget below to learn what all of the widgets on this console do and how you can customize your experience today. With that out of the way, let's meet our speakers. Here today to discuss donor loyalty, we have Glenn McKinney, Vice President, Rescue Missions at Rezard, Jackie Groseth, Vice President, Marketing and Development at the Union Rescue Mission of Los Angeles, and Digital Consultant Todd Whitley. So, Glenn and Jackie, why don't you get started?
Thanks, Margaret. When asked to talk about donor loyalty, it reminded me of a situation I heard recently of a wildlife group out here in the West who had an issue where wolves were getting kind of close to population, so they wanted to train people and actually pay them $1,000 to capture and bring them a wolf so they could relocate them out into the national forest. And there were a couple guys who thought this would be their ticket. This was their get-rich-quick scheme, and so they took the training and they went out into the woods and didn't find any wolves and kind of quickly fell asleep. And when they woke up, there were 40 eyes in front of them with sharp teeth and panting breath, and it was pitch black. And the one friend looked at the other and said, "Oh, we're going to be rich." And I think one of the important things to bear in mind is the power of a positive attitude. And before we get into these statistics, I think it's also important to recognize a problem. And we'll look at numbers and give you some ideas, but I don't want to underestimate the fact that the nonprofit sector is the most resilient and resourceful industry in the world. And just recognizing a problem and applying intentional strategies is more than half the battle. So we'll talk about tactics, and we'll go through the strategies. We'll start by presenting the problem, just giving you some information on that. And Jackie Groseth and myself will give you one simple solution and one simple idea, and then Todd will follow up with some digital strategies as well. So I thought that was just a good story to bear in mind on finding opportunities. So to kind of showcase the problem a little bit, we've highlighted some statistics from the Index of National Fundraising Performance. This is from Q3 2012 from Target Analytics. It's measuring about 37 million donors and about 78 million gifts. And really you can see right there that there is an issue, and it's an issue year to year or quarter to quarter in this report. To me, the most important statistic is the multi-year retention. That is one of the most important things to bear in mind in measuring retention is those folks who have given to you 2 years in a row, are they sticking around? And it is disconcerting to see a downward trend, mild, but when we look at it in another presentation, we can see that it really is a five-year trend when compared to commercial retention of customers. We see that at 94%, where nonprofits are really about 41% donor retention in the past 5 years, from 50 down to 41%. And we spend a lot of time and effort on acquiring new donors, but retaining those new donors or converting them into multi-year donors is only about a 27% success rate. And this is from Bloomerang, a guest post on Katya's blog is where this statistical information is from. Well, let's look a little bit. Oh, before I do that, Jackie.
Well, hi, everyone. I was just going to jump in on this slide and say, you know, despite the fact that we're behind where for-profit is, that's pretty typical of nonprofits as a whole. And the good news is that we can kind of learn from what they're doing and apply some of the basic concepts and principles on the for-profit market, you know, customer retention side to our efforts. And I don't want to assume that we all have a really good handle on where our retention is right now. So if that's something, if you can look at the slide before and you know that your organization is ahead of the national trend, that's great news. And if it's not, at least you know kind of where to start. And if by chance the retention isn't something that you've been looking at so far, that's a question that we can throw out kind of at the end and look at some different ways to get information to you to help you with that. So on the off chance that there's an organization that's just getting started and isn't really looking at retention yet because you're in that growth mode, don't think that we can't address that and get some benchmarks for you. So I've actually used the Index of National Fundraising with our board to kind of show them, you know, because they're always curious about what other people are doing, to show them the national, and then we can compare that to where we're at.
That's a great point. Thanks, Jackie. Let's look at a couple reasons of why donors stop giving and get to the psychology of some of those reasons. 46%, nearly half, according to Cygnus Applied Research, look at it as what we've got is a failure to communicate. Some of the specific reasons listed are losing interest in the cause, believing that there's really no need or that somebody is doing a better job of that, that there's more compelling causes out there, or that donors haven't kept in touch, along with charity not fulfilling its mandate. But again, all things that are issues of communication. And so that's a little bit of why donors stop giving. And so we want to just present to you one simple solution of addressing retention that we feel like will move the needle, as well as a simple concept as well.
Glenn, it's Margaret. Before you go on, can I ask a question that one of our attendees has asked that I think might be good to talk about right in the beginning, if you could take a minute?
Great.
He's asked, why do you think that businesses have an easier time retaining donors than nonprofits have retaining, businesses retaining customers than nonprofits have retaining donors?
Well, that's a good question, and we'll go through some of that. As we proceed, I think it boils down to two big factors. One, I do think there is a difference in a transactional purchase of an item versus giving a gift. I think giving a gift is a different experience, and there's different motivations and reasons for people to do that. So a transaction, people, you know, kind of measure what they want, where they want it, and then go get it. A gift is a little more sacred than that, and the relationship is a little different. I also think that nonprofits could do a better job of, you know, here's this first step of saying thank you and maybe focusing more on the relationship as opposed to the gift and trusting that the gifts will follow. I think commercial organizations realize the value of a customer, and a lot of their programs, you know, customer relationship management, customer lifecycle management isn't about transaction lifecycle management or transaction relationship management. They focus on the customer more than the transaction. And I think doing that will help nonprofits quite a bit.
Okay, great. Thank you. I'm sure you'll touch more on it as you go along, but I just wanted to put that out there before you.
That's a great question. Thanks for asking that.
That is. And I'm going to take over and drive for a moment here. So with that, let me say thank you. Glenn said, you know, we're going to take a look at a real simple idea, and that of saying thank you. But as we all know, it's really not that simple. We've got lots of gifts coming in, and there's things that we need to do to really focus on that. I wanted to start by just looking at a quick study that Chip Grizzard does every year, and this was from 2012. So he made donations of varying sizes to 20 organizations, all on the same day. Of those organizations, 63% sent a thank you, which means the rest did not. The fastest turnaround was in 14 days, and 13 requests to receive email updates. None were received as of 1:15. So, and then you can kind of see what else was going on. So this is just kind of a micro study of some of the things that we were talking about earlier, in that if we're not communicating, if we have those check boxes on our reply forms that say, if you'd like more information about planned giving, check here, we need to make sure that we're actually paying attention to that, and that takes a coordinated effort with our gift processing folks, and there's a lot to go into it. So it's anything from simple, but very important. So we've jumped to getting the second gift, which is a little off because we were talking about thank you, but in order to get that second gift, which is what retention is all about, we need to go back to thank you. So here's some standards to just kind of shoot for, and best practices. That 48 to 72-hour window is so important for first gifts, especially. It's important for any gift, but especially those first gifts. And then some kind of a welcome before a regular appeal. At Union Rescue Mission, we happen to have a great relationship with Andre Ethier, which is a beloved Dodger player, and so we actually have a endorsement letter that goes out from him. We also have the benefit of having folks that are going through our recovery program that we can engage in making thank you calls to new donors, and so the donor has a chance to hear from someone who's actually being helped by that gift. And then send your strongest appeal early. So for a long time, we would just put new donors into whatever the next appeal was, and got smarter about that and said, what's the strongest appeal that we have, and let's use that rather than just, you know, kind of plugging it in. And then also using multiple channels. And, Margaret, this may go back and answer in a little bit more depth one of the things that your question brought up, and that is it used to be kind of if someone, you know, gave to you by direct mail, you forever communicated with them by direct mail, and if they gave online, you forever communicated with them online. And what we know now as we are growing is that we can't make those assumptions, and we're far better off to use multiple channels whenever possible to talk to our donors and constituents. So just some thank you tips. Don't treat it like a process. Easier said than done, but this is not, you know, I guess what we mean by that is make it personal, and this is every bit as important as the appeal or the newsletter. Make it different, not stock. If you've had something that's very specific, a very specific appeal, make sure that you're looping back around with that and your thank you. So if a couple of years ago we had a huge push to save a program, our women and children's long-term program, and we specifically reported back and thanked those folks for what they did and let them know that they had made a difference. Really important, and I know there's a lot just being written about this right now, make the donor the hero, not the organization. They don't care about all our different names and this and that and the other thing. What they care about is what they did, and make it from the heart. Make sure that they know that they've made a difference. That old saying has not gotten old, and that is that you can't say thank you enough. Here's a couple of just real specific examples that you can read in greater detail when you get this deck, but just a couple of highlights here. This is from a children's hospital, and you is throughout the copy, specifically on in terms of what the donor has done. Behind every one of these children, there are compassionate people like you dedicated to helping. Thank you. Your donation will help Starship support children. Your donation becomes truly transformational. That's a good example of donor-specific information. This is one of the series of our thank yous that go out, and this is an e-thank you that is part of the welcome series when someone donates online. So it just greets them for becoming part of our online family. Notice that there's no donate button on this first slide or first page that they would see. If you click on the video, there's going to be a donate button at the end of that, but it's very subtle. It's not the overarching message that the donor is seeing. And this has helped us tremendously. And then finally, here's just a great thank you that has no words at all. This is a photo of a child who's being helped in the field, and it just says thank you. And the donor gets this great photo that they can save and put on their photo on the refrigerator, and they may not remember everything that you said in the appeal, but they remember how you make them feel, and this is sort of capturing it very quickly in a photo and letting them hang on to that memory, which is why ultimately folks give, because it makes them feel good about what they're doing.
Jackie, it's Margaret again. I'm going to interrupt just for another second. I wanted to ask a question that came in from two of our attendees, so I thought maybe it might need some clarification before you go on. People are asking if you could please explain what you mean by strongest appeal.
You bet. So we have a very robust direct mail and e-communication program. We send out at least one direct mail appeal a month. If we're hurting for money, I send out two. And we send out at least one e-appeal a week. So with those, we have some offers that are stronger than others. So just because it's for us, it's a meal-based appeal. So that tends to be how donors come on the file, focused on providing a meal for someone who's experiencing homelessness. And then part of that relationship building is getting into all of the programs and services that we provide. But in terms of an appeal, the strongest appeal, it would be to provide meals for someone. And so regardless of where we're at in the cycle, we might be talking about, you know, sending kids to summer camp. But if it's a new donor that's come into the file, we're going to focus on the strongest appeal, which would be meal-based. Does that help?
Okay, great. Thank you.
And Union Rescue Mission as well will not just put them into the next proverbial queue, but also have language within the appeal that says, you know, as a new friend of the mission, we so much appreciate your recent gift and want to share with you, this update or what have you. So I think just recognizing where people are in their relationship and, planning communications around that as opposed to what are we doing next and putting the donor in the front is really part of that emphasis as well. Well, let's jump to a simple solution, which isn't easy, but it is, you know, an idea of saying thank you to a new concept. And fundraisers love pyramids. There's a top that we all strive for. But really, I think in looking at retention and looking at loyalty, I encourage you to think of circles instead of pyramids. So let's unpack that idea a little bit. The fundraising pyramid, which we all know and love, has a big, strong base of lots of donors, the proverbial haystack, from which we then find needles. We find institutional giving. We identify people who come to special events, major donors, and even those principal investors from there. And so many of those folks, it's really a wave of approach from the technical, the science of fundraising with direct response, with mass communications, to the art of fundraising, with the highly relational work that goes on in moves management and major donor work. And really, a fundraising pyramid is ROI-based. Hopefully, those mass communication programs are operating at a 4-to-1 minimum ROI, meaning that for every dollar you spend, you get 4 back, to make sure that the ratios are appropriate within your expenses. And then really the top is almost an infinite ROI. But the challenge with this pyramid is it really is financially based. Now, what if we thought of a new approach to fundraising that puts the donor at the center of the circle in a donor life cycle and recognizes that there are different stages within relationship and measure those stages differently. Really, people get to know you through their awareness, which really stems from your brand. There's your brand promise, who you say you are, and then your brand perception in the community, who people think you are. And your brand is kind of the knot in the tug-of-war rope that swings between your brand promise and your brand perception. And there are different ways to measure that. And so establishing the right metrics at the right stage of relationship is key. Knowledge and consideration as people build their knowledge about your organization. An example might be a billboard campaign that goes out at a key time to support your fundraising efforts. You want to measure the number of impressions that you think this campaign will bring you by being posted. You also may want to have a target for the frequency of how many people, based off the number of people in the community and how many times they see that, along with the other pieces you're doing. You may want to establish what in the media world is called your frequency. So there are different metrics at different points in a relationship, but this is what we all know and love, is the decision and satisfaction. Send an appeal, thank you, repeat. This is where the metrics we know and love, but in reality it's just two pieces of how a donor might be connected to you. And then, of course, this is what we all want, which is loyalty that even stems into advocacy. These are the experiences. These may be things like, as Todd digs deeper in a few minutes into the digital space, you know, replies per tweet, things that measure the person's connection to you. So instead of thinking of a pyramid, if you think about these different steps within a relationship, within a donor, it kind of brings a new light and puts the donor at the center. So what does that mean for planning? Well, if you think about your communications and what you're saying when, and if you map that out in an annual strategic plan, you might consider, where are you pushing messages? What are you saying in the mail? What are you saying outdoor? What are you saying that you hope people see? And then you might have other communications that are a pull strategy, meaning people find you. This could be, you know, finding you on your website, looking at videos, even hosting a webinar from your organization that speaks about the topic that you're addressing in your community. And then, of course, there's engagement opportunities. These can be events. Social media is a great way to engage. If you think about these different buckets and apply metrics to them, it can lead to donors becoming more loyal. So then you plan your communications within those areas. What is your? When are you sending out direct mail? When are you doing acquisition? And from a pull strategy, when are you doing videos, if you have stewardship programs that ping off of the events that you're doing? And then, of course, engagement opportunities, which could be events, could be, in this case from this charity, is a bridge program, different opportunities for donors to get to know you. So planning from that integrated approach as opposed to planning from the silos of different fundraising programs. So just to give you a quick summary and a quick things to think about, and if you're just going to do one thing as a result of the hour we're spending together, rethink thank you. Rethink the way that you do that. Rethink your approach. Make it as special as the appeal. And then plan from an integrated approach. Define the metrics within the different areas of the donor life cycle that are important and measure them.
Yeah, there's a saying that I use with my team that I would just encourage you all to sort of think about, and that is what gets measured gets done. And I guess that would be my other caveat or answer to why the commercial world is somewhat ahead of us in this game, is that when you start to measure where you're really at with retention and measure how, as you tweak and refine your program, how it can impact what those outcomes are, and that's kind of exciting. This is a cool time to be in development because the rules are changing. We have new tools to play with, and we just need to figure out what that action times frequency equals results is across all of these different playing fields. So as you start to divine that, you go with what's working in your organization, and it's probably going to be different for each one of us.
One of the things that seems to be working really well and people are seeing growth, one of the things I say to the missions we work with is, you know, is in the online space, in the digital space, you know, our fundraising doubled over the year prior. Well, with an intentional strategy, it could probably triple. And it could also lead in different ways because of the uniqueness of that platform to deeper engagement. And Todd Whitley, a digital consultant, is going to speak to that topic.
Great. Well, thanks, Glenn. I appreciate that intro, and Jackie. And thank you, Margaret, for inviting me to this presentation. I've worked online since 1996 for a number of organizations, large and small. And I'm really come to believe that profoundly in the digital space. I sometimes think of myself as a little evangelical in that regard. But for us today, I think there are a couple points I'd like to make and to reinforce from what Glenn and Jackie have shared, and that's the importance of a strategic approach and the opportunity that's in front of us when we consider email and social media in particular among all digital channels. They offer what I believe is untapped potential in keeping donors and donor prospects engaged with our respective causes. I think it's especially true when you consider our collective end goal of creating a culture of philanthropy where our supporters are contributing consistently over time. So with that, I will engage in donors. Now, there are plenty of reasons that we should take digital channels more seriously. I'm sure a number of you on this webcast here are aware of these, but these stats are pulled from the Pew Internet and American Life Project. And it's really quite amazing that, 81% of American adults are online, but for the first time ever, more than half of American seniors. That's a huge jump in that category. And as many of you development people know, this is edging more and more into our ideal prospect pool. And, of course, anyone with a child or a nephew or a niece is very aware of the 95% saturation among teens. And what are they doing? Adults searching and emailing primarily, and the teens. Social networking, although it certainly extends into market profiles above that. And how are folks accessing online? I remember back in 1996, everyone was talking, oh, the digital divide. Well, back then, 15% of Americans were online and broadband didn't even exist. So now we've, come into an age where 60% of Americans 18 and above have access to that broadband. Wi-Fi is becoming more pervasive. And 85% of our country has owned a cell phone. Also interesting, our consumer trends related to the rise of cell phones, laptops, ebook readers, and the decline in sales in desktop, MP3, and game consoles. Those consumer trends, I think, they certainly provide insights into how to approach online. And then, yes, there are reasons that give you pause when you consider investing resources online. And some of these quotes I hear over and over again. Maybe it's because of circles I run in, but even in some of the most advanced organizations, I'm always surprised when someone turns to me and says, I'm just not on that Facebook. I just can't get it. Or what is this Twitter thing? It's just too ADD for me. And then more, reasonable responses like, concerns for additional silos and privacy issues. Well, I say to all of that, these are all valid concerns, but it's our job at this point in time to make sense of that for the organization, for the organization's profile online. And my family would say back home, the horse is out of the barn. If we don't catch up strategically to how to address things from the organization, we'll miss out. And that's the prospect that's in front of us for that. So where to begin? And, again, I appreciate Glenn and Jackie highlighting the failure to communicate as a top reason donors stop giving. Well, if that's the case, then a strategic digital communication plan can be invaluable in measuring and evaluating your efforts. And what I mean by that is an actual, literal plan. Some of you have gone through what's in recent years, relatively recent years, become a very formalized process of developing a strategic plan for the organization. Well, I take that process and I adapt it to the digital channels that exist, looking at the web presence, email, search, social, paid, and crafting a strategic plan that has a communications that has communications as, you know, a central feature of it. And in doing so, what you have is a foundation that kind of level sets an understanding in an organization for what you're doing and where you're going. It can be very helpful in building stakeholder consensus, in reining in, you know, passionate volunteers, and in being much more methodical in a quite a chaotic environment. I've crafted these a number of different ways where it's actually but in any instance, they all should be living documents as let's just jump over something. Okay, so here is formalizing your digital outreach. So in, you know, this can be, this ideally go through the, you know, very similar process here, considering the landscape. What channels are you using now? What channels are you interested in using? And assessing your resources, everything from staff times, you know, volunteer input, budget, certainly, determining goals, engaging internal stakeholders, developing tactics that support your goals, and then measuring the results. And with all of that in place, the document continues to evolve over time. And, you know, one of my favorite people, Seth Godin, and not changing your strategy merely because you're used to the one you have now is a lousy strategy. I mean, that's so perfectly said. But certainly the case here. The point is that you have a starting point, and then use it as a tool to expand how you evaluate success in social media, for instance, or your potential in email. Okay, taking a little delay on my part. But back to our supporters, how do we keep them involved? So when we look at something that I've observed in a number of organizations is there's measurement, but then there's more exact measurement. If you're going to try to build a case internally for investing more in this space, then you need to look how you can identify donations, you know, that are directly related to social networking efforts or email efforts. Measuring campaign effectiveness from a number of different vantage points. Measuring interactions. There are a number of tools available that help you pull together all the platforms you're using in social media and understand if they're, you know, what sort of impact they're having on your reach as an organization. A number of these tools are free. There are certainly some that are available that are not free. But it offers a window into how you're doing beyond the direct donation. And then referral traffic. I think this is really important because I don't believe we look at our analytics enough in terms of the web? Where are people going? There's often a very strong perception in an organization for who your constituents are. But when you go back to the analytics, when you go back to the data, you find that you often find insights that change how you proceed as an organization. So analytics, going back to the analytics, whether it's email or web-related social media, are very, very important. And again, reinforcing much of what Glenn and Jackie were saying. So let's look at email a little bit. This is from a benchmark study that you've probably seen from M&R Strategic Services and N10, a great organization. So in 2012, data pulled from 2011, nonprofits issued an average of 20.82 messages per subscriber. Now, those were fundraising-related messages. And 35% of all online giving for nonprofits was sourced to email. Overall, online fundraising increased 19%. I worked with a number of organizations who developed up a strategic plan for their digital initiatives, their results were much greater than that. So I think, this is an average from a relatively, informed focus group. I think it also speaks to the fact that there's much more room for growth. And when you go back to that earlier slide that looks at behaviors, consumer behaviors right now, and adults searching and using email as a primary behavior online, then I think we have a good case for being much more sophisticated in terms of our email outreach. And with that, I'm talking about going beyond e-newsletters and email blasts to sequence messaging to very targeted appeals. For a number of years now, we've had these resources, the tools actually to do this available to us, but I've observed that it's rare that we've leveraged all that those tools can provide. And so this is something you can do, doesn't cost any money, with what you're doing right now, just by being more thoughtful in how you manage your email base. So how do you know if you're reaching your organization's email potential? Well, recently with some folks, I've conducted an email scan. It amazes me as staff change and as staff changes occur and organization grows or partners, there seem to be pockets of folks collecting email information and sequestering it. So every now and then I've come to believe that it's good to conduct an email audit, if you will, or a scan to see are you consolidating all of the emails that your organization is actually collecting in one form or another. You'll need to work cross-divisionally for this. You'll need to look at some partnering organizations. Third-party partners are often a huge resource for emails that are opted into their communication program but not yours. So scanning that with a keen eye will often lead to a much expanded email list for you. And then optimizing, looking at all the places where you optimize data collection for email addresses both online and off, and making sure that they get fed back into the centralized database for you to manage them more ably. Letting your subscribers manage their own email preferences. Well, this is quite significant in terms of user preferences, and really is a technical issue, but you need to have that in place. And when you have something like that in place, you'll find that you're putting the subscription management options in the hands of your consumer constituents, that the churn that generally occurs of people unsubscribing or getting off lists, because again, often turns into a retained subscriber that is simply preferring to receive a different sequence of communications. So it's invaluable to have this in place so that when someone hits unsubscribe or wants to subscribe to your email program, they're seeing all of the options that you have available, and they're able to manage the flow of those communications as their preferences define. Creating this goes back to some of the content that was Glenn and Jackie, or the messaging points that they've highlighted, but creating content that's unique and targeted. It really stands out. That thank you image was really wonderful. The email that went out, you know, that was this is, again, something that caused, you know, a little effort, not so much money, to be very specific and creative in that regard, to stand out, because we need to get beyond the auto response mechanism that's such a proliferation online. And then examining analytics, as I so fondly said. And in my little example here, this FEGS, Health and Human Services, just to go back to that point about email scanning, when we conducted a scan there, their email list increased 50%. So that was, you know, very effective for them. In other organizations I've worked with, the percentage has been even higher. And now to a little time with maintaining donor loyalty through social media. More data from the eNonprofits Benchmark Study. Nonprofits had 103 Facebook fan page users. That is people who liked or followed them on a fan page for every 1,000 email subscribers. I like this study because it's good to set a good benchmark for your own efforts to go back and reflect on this. And then between 2010 and 2011, the median growth rate for nonprofit fan page was an astounding 70%. What I like about this is it shows that because we manage causes, in a sense, and causal relationships with donors, we have more than any for-profit corporation for-profit corporations, the potential to build a really engaged community online. When I worked with the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, we had a very strong presence of 3 million folks who are in social media followers in various channels. And through a strategic plan I developed, we sort of cultivated that group. And when that was in place, we were very attractive to cause marketing partners because they saw something that they didn't have. You know, they had a great brand, but no online community, sometimes because of the nature of their business, working through a franchise to sell their goods, for instance. So having that is a related asset that is another way to keep donors engaged.
Todd, this is Margaret. Can I interrupt for just a second? We had a few people asking what an email scan is.
Oh, so that's a good question. And so that's looking at where in the organization are you collecting emails. In some large organizations, you'll see that, or I've found that people could have, or they have the advocacy group. They're collecting emails, you know, sometimes using one tool, while you have the development group collecting emails using another tool. You may have a program and services group collecting emails, and then you have a call center that may be accepting emails that are coming in through people's IDs online. So when you look at all of those sort of fractured emails, how are they, and you want to scan them, how are you appreciating providing an opt-in to those people so you can stay engaged with them. So a scan is, I think, really helpful in understanding where that those valuable resources reside. And as I said, like when staff change, as you know, technologies become available, you'll find that suddenly, oh, there may be someone, you know, in this division who's suddenly managing a list of several thousand people. They've developed their own communication program, but they're not really integrated into the overarching one. So I hope that's answered the question.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see where. So approaching social media, identify a set of social networking platforms that match your donor demographics and focus on their success. You know, so with that, it's like perhaps Twitter isn't for your organization. If I think that, you know, I developed the online program for the American Lung Association, who had a very different donor constituency profile than the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Fortunately for me, the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, as social networking came of age, was ideally suited for in terms of the profile, the constituent profile for social networking. It was a wonderful sort of match. Not so much for the American Lung Association. You weren't going to if you think of the launch of social media, you weren't going to easily have 3 million social media followers for the Lung Association, as well known as the name is. For instance, you know, a different set of platforms may serve that organization better. Use social media influentials to gain key marketing insights. So if you're starting from scratch, or if you're looking for insight into how to expand, look among your constituents, your followers online, who is engaging with you the most, who's sharing the most, who is advocating on your behalf the most. And I would say strip out a communication plan just for them. Those are wildly valuable people, especially in social media, because their marketing reach can be more valuable than, even a major donor, I'll go so far as to say. Focus on facilitating engagement rather than leading the conversation. Now, this is the trickiest thing, and not enough could be said about this on this brief presentation, but it's, in social media, social media is not email. The messaging strategy you set up for email isn't going to work in social media as effectively. What you're trying to do in social media is basically invite everyone into the party, and then they're running, it's their party. You are winning by gaining influence and facilitating the conversation, if you will, with your online community. You can do that by celebrating, recognizing, engaging your constituents when you are in dialogue. You won't do that if you're just sharing sort of one-directional messages or calls to action with your base and acting like a corporate entity. So the more you personalize it, the more that you get to the wonderful stories that exist out there, the more that online community will grow for you. And finally, streamline your platform presence. Perhaps aren't in the best order, but by that I mean, on Facebook, for instance, you can have several fan pages, but do you need them all? If you do, Facebook has a way for you to address that by organizing them all under a certain account. You can do the same sort of thing by looking at your presence on LinkedIn in terms of the groups. And in some instances, you'll need to use this, in many actually, your strategy about your social networking presence, and in order to inform whether it's errant divisions, passionate volunteers, chapters out there who, you know, suddenly want to create their own presence. It needs to be, there needs to be a structural sense to it all, and we need to take the donor or the prospective donor's perspective on that. It has to make sense to them. If we're not taking that perspective in all of this, I'll dare say, then we're not really, then we're betraying the all of our efforts here. And so for that social media example, we were talking about measuring. You'll notice that the MNR stats were a little behind the in social networking in terms and versus the email. Email has been around much longer. We have a lot more tools available, and it's difficult to quantify some of those efforts. Also, we've become, in some sense, very good at looking at integrated marketing a number of ways. So even in online, you know, everyone, let's say, pointing to the same donation page. What the challenge that presents is you're not able to turn around and say, hey, you know, this is the number of people who've donated from social media, or this is how valuable that resource is. Or the ROI becomes inescapable to define. So that's why it's really important to kind of make sure that when you're looking at social media in particular, that you are very specific in how you're going to measure it. And you can do that a number of ways. You can by setting up specific landing pages for fundraising, specific campaigns that exist only online. And this GAP, Give and Get example was a cause marketing campaign that ran for a number of years that the Leukemia Lymphoma Society participated in. And it was only pushed out through social media, which is something of a test. We were looking for a way to say, we knew we had a bunch of followers. That at that time it was, you know, less than a million. But we didn't know if we were simply cultivating a community or if we were what the benefit was. Well, this campaign helped us understand what the benefit was. And, you know, these results right here of all the nonprofits that participated in it shows that, you know, LLS had sort of a dramatic spike over the others. That continued for 7 campaigns and a total of over $4 million in less than 2 years. And that was specifically related to the social media effort. And so that brings my part to the close.
Great. Thank you so much. Everybody, we have a ton of questions that we'll try to go through and get them answered. There's no way we're going to get to all of them. So I think what we'll do is once the webinar is over, we'll send the unanswered questions to our speakers, if that's okay, and we can feature them in an issue of Today in Fundraising, which is our daily e-newsletter. And you can sign up for that on the Fundraising Success website. So anyway, a lot of our questions kind of going back to first-time donors. So I think Glenn and Jackie, we're going to address some of them to you. A lot of our attendees want to know, if you get a donation, how do you figure out when it's time to get back to that person? When is it time to send another ask? It can be very delicate. So what are your feelings about that? How do you do that dance with the new brand new donors?
Well, I think it comes down to a lot of what we said in the strategy and practice of setting up a process and then measuring it and optimizing it. So chances are, if you're not doing that currently, you're probably not going to get it right at first. Certainly we'll share some best practices and be specific to give you maybe an approach of that. But it really comes down to optimization, continual process improvement and measuring what the right plan is. It starts with a thank you. It starts with that acknowledgement. As we said, you know, 48 to 72 hours. And I'll kind of maybe ask Jackie if she can kind of go through her steps and people can understand the specifics of what their process is. And, of course, that needs to be optimized. It needs to be measured and measure response. Donors vote with their gifts, and we're all giving in our hearts and giving people the opportunity to give There's no problem with that. So we should embrace that and do it in a wonderful way. So don't be afraid to ask and then try to optimize a lineup. And I'll let Jackie kind of share the specifics of what that lineup looks like.
Sure. I'll just quickly go through where we're at right now, and it's been a process of trial and error. But regardless of the size of the gift, the first thing that the donor gets is a receipt for their gift, and it has a thank you letter as a part of it. It does have a reply device on the bottom, but there's no ask in the letter at all. It's simply, you know, there if they wanted to send in something else. But the letter thanks them for their gift and acknowledges what it was that they gave for, depending on the time of year. And that's whether they can, the first gift is online, via direct mail, whatever the channel. The second thing that every donor gets, I should step back, if that gift amount is over $500, they will get a hand-signed note on that receipt that they get from our CEO, most likely, but depending on the timing and how many we've got going, it could be any of us. Second thing they get is an endorsement letter, which affirms our organization by a third party, that baseball player I mentioned. Then the next thing they get is a thank you call. Sometimes the order of the endorsement and the thank you can be switched up just depending on timing. And then the next thing that they would get would be our best appeal, which is actually it's our newsletter. It's one of our newsletters that we've sort of patterned to be an evergreen newsletter. You can send it any time of the year. So that's our strategy. The phone call and having that best appeal are things that we've added in the last couple of years, and we've seen retention improve. So that tells me we're headed in the right direction.
What about the question of including an ask in a thank you letter? I think that that's been fairly, I don't know if controversial is the word, but it's something that a lot of organizations disagree on. Is it a good idea, a bad idea? And if you don't include an ask in the thank you letter, how soon should you make the next ask?
I guess I would say test it. I mean, I don't, it kind of depends on the organization and how often you're communicating with them. With other times, I'm not sure that there is one right answer. Our thank you letters do have a reply device on it that says, if you'd like to make another gift, send it in. So we know that if you don't ask, you don't get. Our receipt income is pretty hefty as a part of our program, but there's no ask in the letter, you know, could you send another gift at this time? And that's true for new donors or current donors. There's no specific ask in the body of the letter, simply a reply device.
If you do choose to test that and include a reply device along with a receipt and then some body copy that is really thank you focused, include a return envelope too to make it easy for them, just a courtesy reply. It doesn't need to be a business reply, and test that. That's a great point that Jackie made. Typically in the inner city rescue mission community, where that is kind of the standard best practice, is a thankful letter, a receipt, and then a reply device with an enclosed return envelope. Most of the missions actually see anywhere between 8 to 10% of their annual revenue through acknowledgments. So it's actually a net positive for the organization. It just gives them that opportunity that if they are looking to make their next gift, some people just put it in their bill stack, and it makes their lives easier.
Okay, this is something that I think everyone can sort of share their feelings on. When you're trying to determine a schedule for online versus hard copy solicitations and donor retention efforts, how do you find a balance in keeping everybody engaged but not inundating them, especially when you're considering that, you know, multi-channel is more and more the buzzword with nonprofits? So donors are hearing from you through the mail, through email, maybe on Facebook. How do you find that balance? I'm left speechless.
I think it comes down to defining success in advance and establishing your metrics. You know, in the online world, you look at open rates, click-throughs, obviously giving. But again, when we look at engagement statistics and we start to look at things beyond the ROI and establish those as a benchmark of success, you know, are you hoping for anywhere between a 15 to 20% open rate on a communication? If you start to see that dip down to 10 or if it's at 30, you may want to try more or less in the online space. In the offline space, again, you obviously have percent response. You don't have open rates. You can't tell who opened an envelope, but you can see who responded and kind of establish your benchmarks for success there and even build projections in an annual plan of what you're hoping to achieve in response. Donors ultimately speak with their giving, and you can measure the gifts as part of that, but especially in the online space, and Todd shared just some of the metrics around that. There's so many metrics, but to me, an open rate and a click-through rate kind of say whether or not people are raising their hand and saying you're sending too much or not enough. Those are a couple good indicators.
Okay. Well, we could probably spend another hour just asking and answering questions, but we're actually out of time. But I do want to remind everybody that if you sign up for the Today in Fundraising e-newsletter, we will feature some of the answers to these questions in there. On behalf of Fundraising Success and Serenic, I want to thank everyone for attending today's webinar and also thank our speakers. Be sure to check out our webinar page to get information on all of our archived and upcoming webinars. And if you would just take a minute to fill out the brief feedback survey that will appear on your screen, we would be very grateful. That will influence the webinars we bring to you in the future. I hope to see you at the next Fundraising Success webinar, as well as our first live in-person conference, Engage 2013, in Philadelphia on May 9th. You should see a URL on the screen right now, and you can go to that early next week for details. Thank you again, everyone. Have a great day.